A big thank you to our sponsors because they make this show possible, and I hope that you support them the way they support us. Progress Software is the creator of the most comprehensive developer toolkit for building modern apps on the market today, Telerik DevCraft. With more than 1,100 Telerik.NET and Kendo UI JavaScript components and controls, you can easily build modern, high-performance web, mobile, and desktop apps, as well as chatbots. The toolset also includes reporting solutions, automated testing, and productivity tools, and comes with a range of support options. New this year is a free online training program for all license holders. With this, alongside thousands of demos and source code available, comprehensive documentation, and a full assortment of Visual Studio templates, you'll be up and running with the Progress Telerik and Kendo UI controls in no time. Download a free 30-day trial today at Telerik.com/Hanselman. That's Telerik.com/Hanselman. Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and today I'm talking with Eileen Uchitel. She's a senior systems engineer at GitHub and a core member of the Rails team. Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for talking to me about this. I kind of heard about you and the work that you were doing at GitHub when I saw this huge tweet that was sent out in August that said that GitHub had upgraded to Rails 5.2.1, which, you know, by itself isn't an interesting tweet. But then it said that it was the culmination of a year and a half of hard work. So it sounds like some big stuff was happening at GitHub, and I wanted to talk to you about it. Was this a minor upgrade, or what was going on here?
Well, it wasn't a minor upgrade because we started on Rails 3.2, which is two major versions behind. And probably about 6 years behind of where Rails 5.2.1 is.
Oh, wow.
So okay. that was a lot of, that was pretty far behind to be starting out an upgrade like that.
Is it bad to get behind like that? Is that one of those things where just like, hey, life happened and then like life happened and GitHub happened? Or why does one get so far behind?
It's hard if you don't have someone dedicated to doing the work. Previously to me starting at GitHub, someone had started Rails 4.0, but there wasn't a dedicated team to working on it, or even one dedicated person. People would work on it when they felt like it, but that's not a good way to get a major project done like that. So when I started, it actually had stopped booting because the Rails 4.0 build had regressed. So we had to almost start over, even though some work had already been done. It also, features are sometimes more important. So upgrades sort of take a back seat if you don't have a team dedicated to that. And it's easy to say, well, we're so far behind. How are we ever going to get up to date?
So I work with ASP.NET, and that's the web framework that I'm the most familiar with. But I've also done stuff on Django and a little bit of Rails stuff probably 6 years ago, somewhere around the 3.0 timeframe. And every framework feels differently about minor upgrades and major upgrades. In the Rails world, is a major, like, it's major. It's like, this was a huge monotonically increasing integer, therefore we've broken all kinds of things. It sounds like major means major in Rails.
Yes, usually we take it as an opportunity to change stuff that has plagued the framework for a long time, or stuff that we just really want to redo. For example, Rails 6 is drastically going to change how configurations and connection management works. And we're going to do our best to make sure that it's backwards compatible, but some stuff we just have to break because there isn't a easy way or even a possible way of making it backwards compatible. But the future version is going to be so much better that in some cases we feel it's worth breaking to have the better performance or easier to use. Rails current connection management in 5.2 just can't support multiple databases. You have to do a lot of hacky stuff to do it. And so for us to make Rails aware of multiple databases, we have to break the existing functionality.
I see. And this idea of multiple databases, like, not to, again, I'm coming from a place of ignorance. It seems like, are you saying that one Rails app has one connection string to one database, and that's just kind of historical?
Yeah. So active record base is only aware of one connection per environment. So development has one connection. That's how it connects. And that's it. But in GitHub, we have multiple databases with each of those databases having their own replicas. So we need that to work. And we wrote a bunch of hacky stuff to make that work. And so now we're actually taking some of that stuff out of GitHub and putting it into Rails so that we can delete a bunch of code and all of that. And that sort of ties into the Rails upgrade because we couldn't do that before we were on 5.2. You know, it doesn't make sense to take code out of a 3.2 Rails app and try to put it in a Rails 6 framework. So upgrading lets us know where we are in terms of the framework and then take that code that doesn't belong in our app out of the app and put it into Rails.
That's a good point. And all the while, GitHub has to stay up 24 hours a day and move forward and feature work continues.
Yep. We can't stop feature work to be able to do an upgrade, which is part of the reason why we had sort of a small team working on it. It made it so that everyone else could still focus on features and we could focus on the upgrade.
That seems pretty intense. You're basically like changing the tires on a car that can't stop driving.
Yeah, actually, after I did the 4.2 upgrade, somebody at GitHub shared a GIF on Twitter of someone changing the car as well. Tires on a car while it's moving and said that was me.
So that's a good analogy. Also, it seems like, and again, Rails is like time tested and now like a very, you know, it's a 10-year-old framework. It's very smart. It's, you know, like we in no way mean to disparage Rails. It's powerful. But is GitHub one of the larger instances of a thing using Rails or is it medium?
I would think it's one of the larger. We, according to some website, we are the 40th most trafficked site in the US.
Oh, wow.
Or maybe that's the world. I can't remember which number it is. Probably should have looked that up before.
That's all good, but it's big.
But it's big. So, and I looked at the list of the ones before those 40 and none of them are using Rails. So maybe there's ones that I don't know about, but as far as I know, we're one of the largest sites using Rails.
But of course, when GitHub started and Rails and started using Rails when it first started out, I assume that the amount of, like no one thought it would get that big, right? Like no one thought about like, will Rails scale or will this work or will that work? So does that mean that there's a whole bunch of custom stuff that GitHub had to do because it grew big faster than Rails grew?
I wasn't there, so it's hard to say. It may be partially, yeah, Rails didn't grow fast enough, but also it was open source. I think that GitHub was moving so fast that they didn't have time or the ability to change Rails at the same time. Whereas what I'm hoping for going forward is that we change Rails so that Rails is responding to GitHub rather than GitHub responding to Rails.
Oh, interesting. Would that be because GitHub is such a great kind of like practical, battle-tested production example? Like why shouldn't GitHub push Rails in a certain direction? Because then everyone who wants to make a giant application on Rails and grow as big as GitHub would then benefit.
Yeah, that and really, we've scaled Rails in a way that not many other apps have had to. Mm-hmm. And so it makes sense to me to take that out of GitHub because it's not special to GitHub. It's just special to scaling. And so then we can make Rails scale the way we've made Rails scale. And then we have this way more robust framework. Rails 6 is going to be so much more supportive of databases and faster testing and all of that stuff that you need to support a large application.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like the kind of the modern DevOps and the discussion around even that term DevOps has really matured in the last 10 years and the formality behind it is more mature. It seems like GitHub grew with that and then is now going to push some of those conventions into Rails as well.
Yep, definitely. That's the goal.
I'm looking at a GitHub pull request where you're having conversations because you're on the core team with all the other folks, and you're talking about how at GitHub you have 10 plus primary configurations. This is a big and complicated thing, and you basically lay out changes that need to change in Rails to support big stuff like this.
Yep. There's a lot of apps out there that use multiple replicas for their one primary database. One of the things that we have at GitHub, which I think is a little bit different, is we have 10 primaries that each have different tables in them. We don't do sharding. So the tables that exist in the primary for our first database don't exist in our collab database or contributors database.
If I understand what you're saying, it's not 10 copies of the same thing, and you're not just simply pointing an active record to another connection string and saying, keep going. It's 10 totally different things?
Yeah, they're totally different machines and clusters, and they can't talk to each other mm-hmm. because you can't join across separate machines like that. You can't join across completely different connections. So one of the things that we had to do when we split tables off of our databases is find all the joins in the application and break them into two selects. And then each of those 10 databases has a replica configuration. And then we don't just have one replica. We use a GLB proxy layer where to tell the databases which replica to route to.
And just for folks that are listening, so GLB, globally load balanced, and you have a proxy that sits in front of your databases and that helps you make these decisions?
Yes, which is not something that's going to end up in Rails because that's a little bit very specific to how you might want to set up your database stuff. But what we can do in Rails is make it easy so that you can switch between the write connections and the read-only connections.
And when you say switch between, this is something that you're expressing it at runtime, at configuration time?
Currently, you would have to do it manually where you say, when inside a request, you say, oh, okay, well, this dog needs to be created. So I'm going to write to the animals database. Mm-hmm. And then, oh, well, I have a cat and I don't need to write. I just need to read. So then you route that traffic to the replica. So then you're not taking down your primary database while you're writing to it. And you can read from the replica, which helps a lot with performance. For one of the things we do at GitHub, which is probably one of the next things I'm going to work on upstreaming, is we default to the replicas and then we switch to the write databases depending on the request type. So if it's a post request, we switch to write. If it's a get request, we stay on read. What we sort of started talking about in the Rails core chat, whether or not we want to do that based on SQL statement. We haven't experimented with that yet, so we don't know if that's feasible, but mm-hmm. that's one way of doing it. So we say, oh, if this is an insert, we're going to default to the write database. And if it's a select, we can default to the replica. And so that way you don't have to make any decisions in your application, Rails will make them for you.
That's real. That right there is like really interesting and worth like digging into a little bit because, you know, on its face, as someone's reading something, you know, as all engineers do, it's easy to put the word just in front of something, especially when you don't understand it. So I'm sure that when these things come out and someone reads very simplistically into it, they go, oh, you're just doing X, Y, Z. You're not just switching connection strings. You're really putting in some really interesting logic, not just to say, I'm going to connect to this database or connect to that database, but you're expressing your intent and then optimizing the read for scale in a very kind of clever and very, very terse way. And I mean terse in the way that Rails and Ruby are so clean in the way they express things. This connects to API that you've made.
Yep. Yeah. So the idea is to make it easy to understand for mm-hmm. someone. Setting up multiple databases is not an easy task, and applications mm-hmm. starting out for the first time should not be trying to scale before they're ready to. Mm-hmm. But when they are ready, we want it so that you don't have to figure out what API you should write or how you can muck in the private APIs and hack together something that works. Mm-hmm. We want it to be very clear and easy about how it works and what we won't support and what we do support and all of the tools so that instead of spending all this time going, well, how do I set up a database? That part is easy. Mm-hmm. After that, then you're just dealing with, well, where do I put my data? Why do I want to put my data here? And that's decisions you make about your application because that's personal to you. We're not going to we can't make decisions about what tables should go in what databases, but we can make decisions about how do you switch to that connection? And how do you even set that stuff up in the first place? And if we can make that easy, then you don't have to think about the nitty-gritty stuff. Just like you, when you build a new Rails app, you don't have to think about how to create a database configuration. It just does it automatically for you. Mm-hmm. You only have to think about it when you decide that you want to change from SQLite to Postgres. And that's a personal decision.
So you're trying to give people the building blocks to build something on top of Rails that is specific to them. You're being prescriptive, but you're not being draconian in your prescription how they need to do things.
Right. And so even though the Connects to API suggests using writing and reading as your modes to switch to, you could actually name those anything. So for example, in Rails, in GitHub, we call it default. Mm-hmm. So when I port this over to our app, I probably will just change the modes to match what we already have. So then we have less code that we have to change. But because of the way it's written, it doesn't matter. It just matters if you tell your app how to switch.
Interesting. And then some people will not have a load balancer in front of their database, and some people will, and then they can decide what those modes and what, you know, how much the app knows versus how much the physical architecture of the system takes care of things for them.
Right.
Interesting. And one of the things that I noticed that I was kind of impressed with, and I'm just up here on GitHub looking at, you know, GitHub/Rails/Rails, and I'm reading pull requests. The specificity and the quality of the comments as you all talk about this, you can see basically the last several months and even comments from a day, it's very precise language. The community is not just chatting here. It's actually quite formal. How did that culture build up?
Well, so we talk a lot. The core team talks a lot in chat. Mm-hmm. So once we get to actually open pull requests, we've sort of hashed out all of the back and forth of mm-hmm. what's hard, what's not hard, we want to support, we don't want to support. Mm-hmm. And so at that point, we're mostly talking about API and implementation, mm-hmm. but not talking about all of the... we're not bike shedding at that point.
Yeah, you're not arguing about why, you're arguing about how.
Yeah. So especially with that particular API for switching connections, David and I had a conversation separately outside of GitHub about what it should look like mm-hmm. because it was in the first PR that I opened, it was starting to get hard for me to follow the conversation. So in those cases, sometimes we'll just pop into a chat and talk about it. And so originally it seemed kind of like, well, this proposal is might be a lot of extra work for what I'm trying to accomplish in this one PR. So we came to a compromise of we're going to just focus on the connection switching for this PR. And then the next PR, we can focus on changing the configuration so that it's a little bit less. So they're even more prescriptive than they are now mm-hmm. and then move on from there. So I like to work in a very iterative way where I don't want to fix all of connection management in one pull request. I'd rather do it in 15 or 20 pull requests. So then that way, each tiny piece can be made slightly better. And then we're not trying to bite off more than we can chew in a massive PR for trying to solve all the problems at once.
I see. So this particular PR that GitHub and your experience is bringing to Rails, it's not going to, for example, solve, you know, failover where like a primary fails and you switch to a backup. That's something that would be another pull request as you iterate towards a more robust database layer.
Yeah, if we decide to support something like that, I'm unsure whether or not failover is something that we'd want to support in Rails because mm-hmm. that's, again, something that's very personal to your application. Mm-hmm. We don't necessarily know if you've also got a Redis database and another kind of database and another kind of database and like where your code is talking to that mm-hmm. that primary and whether or not we want to support failover. Now, maybe we can in a very simplistic kind of way. But again, that's something that's way further down the line. We have a lot of stuff to fix before we get to the point where we can even consider whether or not failovers are something that we can support.
Mm-hmm. Hey, folks. Today's episode was sponsored by Datadog. It's a cloud-scale monitoring and analytics platform. Datadog was built to bring clarity to complex dynamic applications in the cloud, on-premises, in containers, or wherever they run. With beautiful dashboards, distributed tracing, and seamless integrations with more than 200 technologies, including Azure and Docker and PagerDuty, Datadog provides deep end-to-end visibility into the health and performance of modern apps. Visualize key metrics, set alerts to identify anomalies, and collaborate with your team to troubleshoot and fix issues fast. I'd like you to try it yourself by starting a free 14-day trial today. Listeners of this podcast will also get a free Datadog t-shirt. Get started at bit.ly.com/datadogshirt. That's bit.ly.com/datadogshirt. I want to back up just 1 second to, because not everyone who's listening necessarily knows all the different terms, as well as people who have English as a second language. You said bike shedding. Could you tell me what bike shedding is?
Sure. So there's this story about when there was a nuclear power plant and they're all talking about how to build it. And what they argue about is whether or not what color to paint the bike shed. So the idea is that when all of the bike shedding that we did, talking about the trivial points about the connection management, sort of stuff that we don't necessarily need to be public because we don't want to invite more bike shedding, or perhaps it's something that is more important to someone else. And so you can talk about that stuff and sort of bike shed the little details in private. And then when you're done, you can then talk about the big details and everyone seems it's easier for people to follow the pull request. It's easier for them to follow how stuff sort of evolved. Whereas if you've got 55 comments of back and forth on a pull request, it's just too hard to follow and too hard to read. And people keep asking the same questions because they're not going to read 55 comments. So hashing that stuff out in chat privately makes it a lot easier to display good content later on when you're done.
That seems like it's one of those things where, like, once you've said that, I'm like, wow, that seems like a good best practice for open source. What an obvious thing, but it's not obvious. We all think to ourselves, well, it should be open source. We should have all of this out in the open. But I don't want to see a bunch of people arguing about variable names in the open. I'd like them to be arguing about the big stuff in the open. So that seems like a great best practice that people can take from the Rails core team and then apply to their open source projects.
Yeah. I mean, it happened kind of naturally. It wasn't sort of, it's not stuff that we discussed where we're like, we're going to talk privately about these things and publicly about these things. But when you're talking about stuff that may or may not be trivial or may or may not be stuff that's interesting to the rest of the public, it can be easier to do it in chat because it moves faster. Whereas sometimes in pull requests, you're waiting for that person to respond. They're at work. It's harder to like check your email and then, oh, okay, now I need to write up a well thought out response. Whereas when you're chatting, you can just sort of be a little bit more impersonal.
Right.
And I think as far as some other stuff that I've worked on, this was not as much bike shedding as other stuff that I've worked on. So it seems a little bit unfair to call it bike shedding because it was all important stuff, but it also did help to not debate the littler things and timing of other pull requests and stuff in the pull request itself. So that stuff is easier to discuss in chat.
So popping back off the stack to the upgrading, you're taking things that you identify that GitHub does as best practices, you're pushing them into Rails so that the world will then get those benefits, but you're kind of slowly but surely upgrading the site. Are you going each minor version and then going live, or did you go literally from 3.2 to like 5, or did you know, like, how often did your little team poke back at production and say, all right, we're going to upgrade to this one and we're going to upgrade to that one? Because you're going to have to chase their feature requests, their features that they're working on while simultaneously upgrading.
Right. So the way that we did it was we decided to deploy 4.2 and 5.2. Mm-hmm. So part of the reason we couldn't deploy 4.0 or 4.1 was because those two versions were vulnerable. They've been EOL'd for a long time, and they're at their end of life, so they don't get security backports.
So you went to the long-term support versions of these things.
Yeah. So 3.2, while also wasn't supported anymore, we were supporting it, but we hadn't been supporting 4.0 and 4.1, so we couldn't deploy those because we didn't know what was in them that might be vulnerable, so we had to go to 4.2 to deploy that. So the way we did it was we did each minor. So we did 3.2 to 4.0, and then we would take that and we would make a build required. So every single push to GitHub had to pass the main 3.2 build and the 4.0 build. And so then we went to work on 4.1. When 4.1 was done, we replaced the 4.0 build with 4.1, And then we made that required. So every single pull request that went into GitHub had to pass those two versions of Rails. And that's how we prevented regressions.
Interesting. So that seems like a good best practice as well. Like you could rip the Band-Aid off fast and just say, come on, we're all going to 5.2, woohoo! But by doing it in a stepwise fashion to supported and kind of LTS or long-term support versions, you're kind of avoiding risk and also learning as you move forward.
Yeah, and it also helped set everyone else up so that they knew what was coming in the next version. So instead of going straight to 5.2 and just being like, well, the way you write half of your code is different, it was easier on the rest of the engineers in the organization to do it slowly so they could just sort of get used to things changing, having to write stuff two different ways, understanding how Rails upgrades work, understanding how to condition your code so that it works in multiple versions. All of that stuff is really important so that teams don't get frustrated with an upgrade because mm-hmm. you don't want to lose momentum because of something because you went too fast.
Right.
Going too fast can sometimes derail everyone else, and that's just not going to help you get that stuff pushed out faster.
Mm-hmm. You got a lot of flack. You all, your team got a lot of flack on in the comments. And of course, we all know never read the comments because people kept saying, well, why did it take so long? It seems like it took long because there was a surprisingly large amount of work going on here, but also detangling, you called it things that were maybe too clever that GitHub had done to build custom bits. So you were kind of refactoring by subtraction, like, oh, we did this custom, but we don't need to because Rails does it now.
Yeah, so it took a long time, one, because it started out as a hobby mm-hmm. for other people. So it didn't really, when I started, there hadn't been enough work done to say that 4.0 was even half done. It was basically not started. Mm-hmm. There had been work done, it still had something like 1,000 failures. So that's not anywhere near done. And for the most part of the first year, I was the only full-time engineer on it. Mm-hmm. And even I didn't work on it full time because it's too much. So I took a lot of breaks and we had mostly volunteers who'd fix one or two failures while I mostly did all the deploys and made sure that that code was correct and figured out what the next thing everyone would work on would be. Mm. When we got to five, after we deployed 4.2, that sort of proved that we could upgrade. I think there was a lot of hesitation about whether or not it was something that we could do. Mm-hmm. Not because it hadn't been done before, because 2.3 to 3.0 was so hard, partially because GitHub had at one point decided to stay on 2.3 on a fork. And so untangling that and some of that stuff was still left. So we had to not just upgrade, but we had to untangle decisions that had been made. We had to figure out if every failure, you have to figure out, is this a bug in Rails or is this a bug in GitHub? And you can't just fix it because you don't know, especially with how old Rails was at that point. Mm-hmm. And so when you're on that old of a version, you can't request changes to 3.2 mm-hmm. or 4.0 or 4.1. You can't ask for a feature to be merged into it so that you can get a new version. So you have to have a fork. And our fork had also had stuff added on top, so it was hard to figure out, is this something that actually should have been backported? Mm-hmm. Is it not? And then dealing with all of that stuff. And a lot of the people who had done that work were no longer at GitHub. So it's not like there's someone you can ask, hey, why did you do this particular thing this way? Mm-hmm. You have to figure it out. And sometimes there aren't answers in pull requests or in commit messages.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's so easy when someone is an armchair quarterback or an armchair Rails committer that they can look at something and say, well, I don't know why they didn't just upgrade in a weekend, to take the 40th largest whatever traffic website that running on Rails and upgrade it, you know, is not a simple thing. Not to mention, I assume that there's testing things to think about as well. Like the Rails and Ruby community are well known for their love of unit testing, but I don't know if you necessarily had full coverage of all of GitHub, right? You could break something indirectly and cause all kinds of trouble.
Yeah, I was surprised at how good our tests actually were.
Yeah.
When we did do deploys to production, well, first to our staging environment and then to production. Mm-hmm. In the staging environment, we found less than 10 new issues. And then going to production, we also found less than 10 new issues. I think total for the 4-2 one, we found 15 unfound issues. And then for 5-2, I think we found 6 or 7. So it really wasn't, it was pretty well tested. We didn't have system tests or capybara tests, whatever. Everyone has different names for them. Rails calls them system tests. Some people call them acceptance tests, mm-hmm. where you boot a browser and it clicks around and does stuff. We don't have those tests. So we were mostly relying on our controller and model tests or unit tests. Mm-hmm. But those were pretty decent, considering that we also were not using the Rails testing framework. We like kind of wrote our own on top of Rails, which is mostly gone now. Something else that by upgrading we were able to do that we couldn't have done before, because that was originally created because Rails didn't have the features that we needed. Mm-hmm. And so then once we upgraded, Rails had those features, we could delete all that code or the majority of it. And so that's sort of like, sometimes we were refactoring stuff. That's why it took long. Sometimes we were just tired of working on it. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I would stop working on that to do something else. So there was one piece of code that had a couple of test failures in the app. And after looking at it, I realized that it was code that wasn't used. So I took a month to remove that code. And I'm sure someone's going to be like, why did it take you a month to do that? Well, it was literally everywhere in the code base. Mm-hmm. So I had to slowly back out that code, basically reverse engineer deleting it. It took 7 pull requests to delete all of that code.
Oh, wow.
Safely.
So as we close our interview here, let me ask you this. How will you make sure that this doesn't happen again in 10 years? Are you following the mainline more closely now?
Yeah. So right now we have a build that is hooked up to Rails Master, mm-hmm. and it runs every evening. We thought about making it required, but Rails is in such flux right now. I don't want to derail other teams from getting progress done. So we're going to monitor it for a while and see, are there bugs in Rails? Are engineers introducing more regressions, or is Rails introducing more regressions? And once we have a little bit of an idea of how Rails Master is behaving, we may make it required as we get closer to the beta. Mm-hmm. And then that way, we already have upgraded the app. If the test pass on the day that we release Rails 6, will be my definition of success in this, because then the day after we release Rails 6, we can deploy to production.
Very cool. So you've basically taken your last year and a half and automated it yourself, put together a process to ensure that it will allow everyone to upgrade more cleanly, and you've got a safety net.
Yep. Yeah. So once you're on that new version, testing against Master is a lot easier. I mean, it also is a lot easier, especially if you're the person who's breaking Rails. You know how to fix your application. But again, like I said, we're going to try really hard not to break applications too much with Rails 6.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much for chatting with me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was great.
I've been talking with Eileen Uchitel, Senior Systems Engineer at GitHub and a Rails core team member. This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.